Welcome to Lynn Cullen Live, talk radio without the static. Email your questions and comments to lynncullenshow@gmail.com. And now your host, Lynn Cullen.
Hey there and welcome. May 12th, another gorgeous sunny day. Yowee. It's amazing how it lifts your spirits, isn't it? And I need them lifted today, I'll tell you that. Hey, by the way, coming up later in the show, we're going to get a visit from one of my favorite people. He is a renowned documentarian. He's Braddock's own, Pittsburgh's own, Tony Buba. And if you've never seen his work, well, that's your loss. I'd be shocked if you hadn't seen some of his work. It's all over the place. And also, he's just one of the nicest human beings ever. And he is going to be honored next week at the Carnegie Museum of Art. He has been honored many places, many museums. His resume takes in all the names you'd expect a renowned filmmaker to have. All the major film festivals, the grants from every major foundation, and he's just the nicest human being in the universe, Tony Buba. So he'll be stopping by to talk about his films, and mostly the one that will be screening, and you're invited, screening at the Carnegie Museum of Art next week, Lightning Over Braddock. Okay, so that's coming up. And the only other thing I want to reiterate, and I do so with some apology, I feel like I've been absent a lot this year. There was that month-long absence at one point, and then I'm going to have to be absent again next week. And as I said, it's poisonal, it's health related, and it's just something that has to be done. This is just part of the, I guess, normal aging process. But rather be alive and enduring that. So one of the things I find fascinating is, the primary is what, next week? Is it next week? I've already voted, so I lose track, but I believe it is next week. And there's a lot of unknowns. And there's a lot of races that I really do care about, and I'm trying not to think about it because, I so dread electoral outcomes often. I fear because there've been some doozies in our recent history, obviously. The Pennsylvania primary in the governor's race is unexciting on the Democratic side because it's just Josh Shapiro, and he by all indications is an extremely talented politician and a diligent office holder. I got nothing against this guy thus far. And he's a formidable opponent for any Republican who wins the Republican primary. And that's what I want to talk about, the Republican primary. Whoa. First of all, it is an embarrassment of horrors, the possibilities. And apparently, and this is actually made the New York Times today, a pretty big article about how, the headline is Pennsylvania voters veer hard right. It's not Pennsylvania voters. I get so mad. You know, I'm getting close to canceling my New York Times prescription. I'm sorry. doing a lot of prescriptions lately. Subscription. They drive me crazy. Pennsylvania, hey, you Pennsylvania voters out there, are you veering hard right? They mean Pennsylvania Republican voters. There's a difference. Please. Anyway, the Republican voters are, it appears, veering hard right. And the people who look like they're going to win are all Trumpers. And, well, everyone says they are, because you have to. And but the race has largely been seen, the governor's race, as just this, you know, wild panoply of possibilities. And probably the most extreme, it is true. The person who will probably go up against Josh Shapiro for governor is Doug Mastriano. He currently sits in the legislature, state senator, and he is as right wing as they come. I mean, by right wing now, I mean, he says Trump won the election. He was quite willing to give over the votes of the people of Pennsylvania to the Trumpers, even though that is not how we voted. He's so far right that he's scaring a lot of the Republican establishment in I'm sorry, you know what's happening? My brother and my sister and my sister-in-law are engaged in a messaging back and forth. They've been doing it for an hour, and I'm on that, whatever you call that. I'm in that group. And but my phone is going, you know, even though it's not swooshing like it was, it's now, you know, this beep, beep, and it is really making me nuts. The problem is they're having a conversation that if I were to say, would you please take this someplace else? It would look churlish on my part. So I'm sorry. I'm going to try to ignore it, but it's just, it's constant. I'll take it up with them later. So if, you know, the article quotes some Democrats in Pennsylvania who say, you know, man, you know, in their wildest dreams, they're hoping Mastriano wins because they figure he is so extreme. There is no, and Shapiro is such a good candidate. There's no doubt that we will have a win in the governor's race, which we need, because without it, Pennsylvania will join the states in which abortion will become illegal. I have little doubt of that. So there's that. But then there's this cautionary note. Because one Democratic state rep said this article. I should be happy that Republicans seem to be on the way to blowing these races, talking about the Senate primary and the gubernatorial primary, he says. But I am very nervous that lo and behold, two Republican extremists could be elected governor and senator. And what he was saying is something, because he actually has a memory. He remembers how the Democrats so often felt like, well, there's no way that guy's going to get elected. And I give you Donald Trump. And I give you back to 2010. And the Tea Party candidates were laughed at in a similar way. There's no way. So many of them won. So it's sort of a scary thing. We're all hoping that we know the weakest Republican candidate and want them to win. But the reality is it could be one of those be careful what you wish for. On the senatorial side, it's more interesting in that Trump's candidate, Oz, does. I would be shocked if he won. I would. I have thought from the beginning that Dave McCormick seems to be the candidate that most Republicans would go to. But in this day and age, who's to say? I certainly don't have my finger on the pulse of the Republican electorate at this point. In this divided nation, I can't be said that I, you know, live amongst them and socialize with them. I don't know how far right they're willing to go. But an interesting development in these last days till the primary, much like the Kentucky Derby race that just happened, is a horse no one even talked about, no one whose name you even knew, as apparently in the latest polling, and again, polls, who knows, who doesn't, has pulled even with Dr. Oz and McCormick. And that is a woman, a black woman named Kathy Barnett, who is without a doubt the most conservative of this trio. Without a doubt. I saw her first ad on television, I think it was yesterday. And, wow, she's got TV ads because she had no money. Nobody knew her. Nobody was backing her. And the New York Times article tells me now she's getting backed and she's getting money at the 11th hour, at 11:45 hour. She's getting money from some big sources such as the Club for Growth. Now, the Club for Growth is, at bunch of conservatives, is one of the biggest spenders always in Republican elections. And they've now given her a few million bucks, which is what paid for that advertisement I saw last night. So she's all of a sudden garnering big attention. And it could be that coming out of nowhere, as Oz and McCormick have savaged each other with all that despicable negative politicking that we have come to wearily accept as what we do in elections, because we're told it works. It could be that those two guys are going to, like, have harmed each other so much that she could come out of nowhere. Unbelievable. And if Fetterman wins on the other side, that would set up a fascinating, geez. So anyway, hold on to your hats. This is something. Kathy Barnett. I mean, she is as she was is so far right. She was calling. I mean, she's so far gone. I want to say she was calling Barack Obama a Muslim. I was for all I know yesterday. I mean, she's never let go of that. Okay, some other things I just want to get to, and I feel like I'm not being very coherent today, and I'm sorry. Showing how totally misguided and unbelievably stupid the invasion of Ukraine was for Vladimir Putin is the news today that the nation of Finland, which has long long been a country like Switzerland that refuses to supposedly take sides. And they're sitting, they have a long history with Russia, not necessarily a pleasant one. Seeing what Russia did with Ukraine, they have now done something that they've never done before, which is they are now actually formally asking NATO to take them in. They want to join NATO. Now, what's fascinating about this is that, again, the, turned on a dime, the Finns' feelings about that. This is not something they had historically wanted. 6 months ago, a blink of time, the Finns were polled and asked if they favored joining NATO. And a whopping 20% of them said yes. 20% said yes. A poll taken maybe yesterday or the day before, that 20%, now 80%. You don't see, I mean, you don't see a 60% jump like that on in that short space of time, almost ever. They're scared. Now, of course, one of the reasons that Putin invaded Ukraine, apparently, he said, they keep changing these reasons, but was that Ukraine wanted to join NATO, and he considered that almost an act of war. Because, as you know, with NATO, if one of its member countries is attacked, that is considered an attack on all. So NATO comes to the defense. And I got to tell you, I don't see the difference between Finland and Ukraine in that regard. And so Putin, thinking he's drawing this line saying you cannot expand NATO to these countries that sit on my border, or I'll take those countries for my protection. That's his thinking. Finland, not worried that he means that, now says to NATO, we want to come in. Of course, all of this creates a much more incendiary situation. Sweden, too, is on this road, moving toward applying to NATO. Something to really watch. But again, showing what an extraordinary miscalculation Putin made. I just want to say, and again, I haven't watched the news, so I don't know how much it's being played up, but the pearl clutching and hysteria on the right over protesters, nonviolent, totally nonviolent, and mostly, I understand, respectful and silent protesters in front of Justice Kavanaugh and I think Alito's and Roberts' house. Apparently, Roberts and Kavanaugh live almost side by side. Must be a nice neighborhood, a neighborhood unaccustomed to such, well, shenanigans. And I find it fascinating the hue and cry. The governors of Virginia and Maryland, where these justices live, both Republicans, have asked Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, actually not asked, I would say demanded, that he enforce the law. And apparently, and I didn't know this, federal law forbids demonstration that are intended to sway a judge on a pending case. Did you know that? The little bit I saw about it, I said it was from the 1950s. That figures, because we're back in the 1950s. That somehow, at some point, somebody carved out did another thing to the First Amendment and said that protesting in front of a judge's, well, I don't know, even courthouse, it doesn't say his house, demonstrations intended to sway judges pending a decision on a case are not allowed. What the hell? Now the people in front will say, we're not trying to change his mind. We're pissed off. We just want them to know we are so, so angry. So who the hell knows? Garland, at least as far as I know at this point, has not moved. But there's been efforts to bring law enforcement in to quash these. It's quash, by the way, not squash, to quash these protests. But in one case where I guess whatever the local government is in Virginia, where Kavanaugh lives, the attempt was made. And the local government pushed back, citing the First Amendment. Whoa! Even though there was a law that said something about you can't demonstrate in front of people's houses because it disturbs the neighborhood. And the feeling there is that law would be unconstitutional. Now, I'm thinking back to Black Lives Matter and the very noisy demonstrations in front of Bill Peduto, the mayor's house, which is just pretty much straight down about a block from me. And I would hear it. And those went on sometimes night after night. And, you know, where the houses are really packed together in a very residential area. And I did, I must admit, I felt for people there because I could hear it up here. And, you know, it was loud and annoying, and I told you about my experience the first day I lived in this house, having anti-abortion protesters squawking and screaming outside my house. It's not pleasant. It's true that what I call pesky First Amendment. But I find the irony here, and the thing I find so the justices here are obviously angry that the quiet of their home is being violated. The right they feel to privacy and the enjoyment of their personal lives, right, is being disrupted. I'm sure, and I, you know, if I were a friend of Justice Kavanaugh's or Roberts or any of the others, I would say I understand. It's horrible. I feel your pain. I really do. But these are the guys that by all indications are about to mandate. They got power we don't have. Are about to mandate that the right to privacy does not extend to women's very bodies, never mind their homes, their bodies. And when I balance those two, Kavanaugh in a snit fit because the quiet of his enjoyment in his neighborhood is under attack. Wonder if he ever asked himself What brought those protesters in front of his house? What brought them out? The fact that he and his brethren on the court are going to say that a woman has no right to the private control, enjoyment, whatever, of her own body, that belongs to the state. What? I find it fascinating. I mean, really fascinating. Oh, God. All right, so there was that. Beth, wow. I saw a piece last week about the amount of money McCormick is getting from Goldman Sachs. Well, yeah, his wife is a partner in Goldman Sachs. She was also a high-ranking official in Donald Trump's White House. Anyway, it mentioned how all the executive management at Goldman Sachs has contributed the federal maximum already to his primary campaign. Stephen Miller, what a wonderful human being, is working on the campaign and taking no salary, wink, wink. As someone who used to run state of Pennsylvania races, Beth says, it is scaring the crap out of me, the amount of money, yeah, flowing into these primary campaigns. The billionaires now purchase U.S. Senate seats. They're going to own all of our means of communication. They're going to own space. Yeah. Elbow NASA aside, that's right. No, these billionaires, you're right, Beth. And this is why when I talk about our corrupted system, this is part and parcel of that corruption. Yes, billionaires are now able to purchase Senate seats, presidencies, whatever. Oz isn't getting money from Goldman Sachs, but is getting money from a long list of who's who in the hedge fund world, and we'll throw in Tommy Hilfiger too. The other part of the piece was how many senators have relations with Goldman Sachs. Ted Cruz's wife is the manager of wealth management there and has access to the wealthiest in this world. Tommy Tuberville, there's another brilliant Republican senator, his son is a rising star in the investment banking division. And she says, I love, love, love Josh Shapiro, but I wish he were running for the Senate and Fetterman was running for governor. Wow. Yes. Yes. That'd be better. You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right. That'd be better. Good one, Beth. Thank you. Hey, I don't know if any of you are following, and again, if you get your information like from Twitter, you're getting information that is not necessarily picked up by mainstream media, depending on which mainstream media you're accessing. I don't know. Now, some of this has been leaking into mainstream reporting, and that has to do with the guy who ran John McCain's presidential race, Steve Schmidt, who I think is one of the smartest, most eloquent observers of American politics there is. He is very active on Twitter, and he came out in the last days with the most vitriolic diatribe against Meghan McCain and how he wasn't going to lie. And anyway, some of this has gotten into the mainstream media and has to do with the fact that during the campaign, the New York Times wrote a piece about McCain apparently having an affair with a lobbyist. And the lobbyist threatened to sue, and John McCain and Cindy McCain came out, and they were furious and denied it. And Steve Schmidt, the campaign manager, hotly denied it. And what he has come out and said in recent days is that he lied for McCain. But much of what and that the horrible daughter has been threatening him for 14 years, he said. And so he's decided to just spill it all out. I also believe he has a book coming out, just so you know. All right. So enough of that slimy, revolting, repulsive reality. I can't take it. Let's move instead to something I'm looking forward to. And that is talking to Tony Buba, who I understand is on the line. Tony, hello.
Hello. How are you doing, Lynn?
I've worked myself up into a hot lather as usual.
Yeah, I thought I had a flashback to 1980s.
Well, I was just talking about we're going back to the 50s. This country is spinning backwards so fast. It's unbelievable.
I know. It's the attacks are just incredible. I heard you talking about the amount of campaign spending. I mean, it's just inconceivable. There's millions of dollars being spent on the campaign in the 12th congressional district here. I mean, it's like $2 million in attack ads have been going out. I mean, that money can be used for a lot better purposes.
Yeah, tell me about it. Isn't it fascinating though? Those people. That money is not being spent if not the fact that the people spending it feel there is that much more money at risk, right?
Right, right. It is. Because I was like, you know, well, up front, I'm a big Summer Lee supporter. So, and it's just like, I was just
what
thinking
the
like 4 years. 4 years ago, when we first started, my wife and I first started campaigning for Summer. I mean, nobody knew her, and then she ended up upsetting Paul Costa. She had absolutely no money. But in those 4 short years, I mean, she's gone from like having a campaign office in an abandoned barber shop in Braddock to becoming like one of the most feared people by Rich Fitzgerald. I mean,
the entire Democratic establishment. My God, you would think she was, the most terrifying human on earth.
Yeah, and look, I mean, her accomplishments, and actually it's her, the way she speaks, she always talks about building a movement, and what done, if the people that have got elected, especially the last election with the judges Sarah Amorato and others, these women that they've really become a force within the Democratic Party. They're just opposing Beth Hallam and others who are just really amazing.
Right, which is why all the white men that have the power are just going berserk.
I know.
And why they can.
Wish Badudo Fitzgerald would just go to Rite Aid and get the, you know, and get their hair dye and just sit back.
Well, I just, which is why they had to go get the great white hope, Steve Irwin, and shower him with all his money.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me was critical in this election. We definitely have to elect a Democratic governor, or things are going to be in shambles because you'll have the veto vote. And what I'm concerned about, if Irwin beats Summer, I mean, Irwin doesn't seem to have the personality that's going to get out the vote. Where Summer, she's well respected in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and the amount of young people and people across different lines, but ethnically, age-wise, that support her. I mean, she has increased voter participation in every election she's run in, and I think she's really needed to get out the vote in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia to make sure we have a Democratic governor and senator.
Although I have to tell you, I can't imagine that we're not going to have that Shapiro doesn't beat any of these clowns. Although, you know, you have to remember Donald Trump was elected, so clowns clowns can be elected. Oh man! So, I don't know if you brought up politics. We got to get to this. I just need you because you're Braddock. I mean, when people think of Braddock, you are the bard of Braddock.
Yeah, I moved up from the Boswell, Braddock's Boswell, to the bard of Braddock.
Yes, right. Yes, you have. We've got to alliterate.
That's right, which you're wonderful at.
So, Tony Buba, you were born in Braddock?
Right, right.
He lived in
Braddock up until 2001. Then we moved. Then they were supposed to do that Monfette Expressway. It was going to take our house. So we built a house on actually my grandfather's property in Braddock Hills.
Wow. Moved all the way away to Braddock Hills.
Hills, yeah.
Well, here's what I wanted to get at. The other person, I always thought when you say Braddock, Tony Buba is the name that comes up. Somebody stole that from you.
Yes.
Of whom I speak?
Yeah, Mr. Fetterman.
Yes.
Yeah, who actually I don't get along with. Yeah.
I know.
It's and, like, we haven't spoken in about 15 years, I guess. I don't know.
Wow.
But yeah.
So just so people know, because he's widely believed to he's going to win the Democratic primary.
Yeah, I think what I never understood about Lamb's campaign is or even Kenyatta. Why don't they just do a piece of drive down through the streets of Braddock and say, you know, if John calls a success, what does he consider failure? I mean,
that's good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's just wide open.
Do you think he used Braddock? Do you think all was that all of this has been intended from day one? Do you see him as that Machiavellian?
No, it just happened. Yeah, I mean, right timing, right circumstance. I mean, just a lot of different things. When he first ran for mayor, the vote was split between. There was another candidate that ran against Pauline Abdullah because she was upset about something. So they really split the vote. I think one had 400 some, the other one had 300 some, so John had tied with the one. I mean, if the other person hadn't run against Pauline, then Pauline would have won hands down. But yeah, he's been really fortunate in his whole career and stuff like that happening. I mean, the run for lieutenant governor, you had that idiot that was in office before him. So he's had a pretty fortunate run.
and he has another one. My son came up with a thing for Connor Lamb the other night. He said, Lamb is bad.
Yeah.
I said, all right, okay. So who are you voting for?
Who am Kenyatta. I voting for?
Yeah, Kenyatta.
Either Kenyatta or Lamb. Yeah, probably Lamb. I mean, it would be the most conservative person I ever voted for my entire life. But yeah, that would be. But I don't know, I think Fetterman has it sewed up for winning the primary. What I don't know is what will happen in the fall.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't
you
think.
You want to vote for the, th- yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think either McCormick or Oz or Bart will really will take it that easy on him and probably will run those type of ads. I mean, they'll really hammer home the gun incident and another one where you try to close down to one bar that was in Braddock, was, you know, minority owned. But then, they'll hammer in also just Braddock itself, the closing of the hospital and that kind of thing. And that's why this is why I do think for like if we want to elect a Democrat for senator in the fall is why we got to elect Summer Lee. I mean, the other thing that's been disappointing about John, he's never supported Summer Lee. He's never endorsed her. Yeah, which is interesting.
Maybe he sees her as another white man who sees her as a threat, perhaps.
Yeah, a threat, perhaps, or just that he doesn't want to go against the Democratic establishment.
Well, that's true too. Oh, brother, you mentioned
it's all so complicated, Lynn.
You mentioned Brett. You know, that's interesting because I'm thinking of one of your shorts that you did. That is your work is seemingly not complicated often, but but on the other hand, and on reflection, it is. I'm thinking about simply washing walls with Mrs. G.
Oh yeah, one of the all-time favorites of the films I've made, one of my grandmother, right? Yes.
Oh, I mean, for those of you, how long is that? About 10 minutes or something?
5 minutes. It's 5 minutes.
Oh, it's just 5 minutes.
It's just 5 minutes, yeah.
And it's Tony's Italian grandmother, and talking about her.
Yeah, every year I had to wash walls for her, the kitchen walls, because, you know, we're living in Braddock with the soot and the pollution, the walls would get dirty even inside the house. So every year I had to, you know, wash the walls. So 1 year I worked with Nick Mastandra. I said, let's just shoot a film. I had like 12 minutes of film available. I had four 100-foot rolls that are like 3 minutes apiece. So we had four walls in the house. So we said, well, let's shoot 100 feet on each wall and talk to my grandmother. We'll just keep her in the middle of the frame, and whatever happens, happens. And it turned out that it did the film. Then I actually played the film, and nobody could understand her accent, which I couldn't figure because I've heard it all my life. So then that's why I ended up playing with the subtitles on it. And
you had to have. You know, I tried to close my eyes, and I couldn't understand her.
Right. Yeah. She spoke. Yeah, here she had the thing that, the thing is interesting with my grandmother, I mean, especially with my mother. After my dad passed, we took her to Italy with us a lot of times. And that's what I'm working on now is a footage that I've shot over the last 20 years of my mother and going back and forth to Italy. And then she ended up dying of Alzheimer's. So it's going to have to deal with memory, Alzheimer's. I'm not quite sure what the portal is into the film, but playing with it. But we took her to Italy the first time. And here, she came to America when she was 8 years old. And so she ended up becoming the last living person who spoke the pure dialect of that village. So they would come out with tape recorders and ask her questions and tape her because her sentence structure and the words she was using. I mean, there was stuff. I mean, she came over in 1929. So that's the language she knew what existed in 1929 before the region was affected by other languages and Italian itself. So it's, So she was like she was like a little queen in that village whenever we would go over.
What is the village? Where in Italy?
It's called Tursi. It's in Basilicata, and it's not far from Matera. And Matera is the site of a famous book called Christ Stopped at Eboli by Carlo Levi, and it's where an area where Mussolini exiled people who opposed him during World War II, and as Carlo Levi was exiled there, he's a doctor from the North, and it writes about the poverty of the South, and the whole thing of it was so poor, this region where my mother was from, that there's a town called Eboli, and Christ must have stopped there, or he'd have seen all that poverty, and wouldn't have let these people suffer so much. I mean, it's a really great book.
Wow.
But so she came over, so the only person she spoke with was with my grandfather and my grandmother, and they both spoke dialect. So she was untouched by Italian language. And the dialect is not like a Pittsburgh accent. It's really a different.
It's
different word. It's like for cat. You know, the Italian word for cat is gatto, but she would say yayat.
Yeah, so it's really it was another, I mean, so an average Italian would not understand the language.
Right. An average, if we were in Rome, they would not understand what she was speaking.
Uh-huh.
We go down to her village, they would understand because they still heard that from their parents and grandparents, and some of the words are still in the language, but she just spoke pure dialect. And the thing that was really moving, my brother and I were named honorary citizens of my mother's village in 2000. So we had the celebration there, and they were reading poetry in the piazza, and there was this poet, his name Albino Piero, who was nominated for the Nobel Prize in poetry, in dialect poetry, because he wrote in the dialect. And so they were reading those poems and reading them. So my mother gets up in the middle of it and says, this is the first time she ever understood poetry. Because I was brought us to tears, my brother and I, when she said that. When she spoke English, she had no accent, but she really, the comprehension of the language wasn't what she had in her dialect. And the dialect is really, it's, you know, Southern Italian, a little melancholy and you know, and just fatal, whatever, fatalism involved in it. Yeah, but there was, And actually, when my mom passed, they published an obituary with her in a newspaper over there in the village, in this Mezzogiorno, the South of the Sud. They had her, the person that interviewed her wrote a bunch of things that she had said. And the way she spoke in dialect was really moving. I saved you a bit. And I remember you actually came to my mom's funeral home when she had passed. And I appreciate that. But yeah, she had said that, you know, as she comes back to Italy, she's like caught between two worlds, and she feels like she's a protagonist in her own film. I mean, she also knows this is at the time now, sort of the end of her journey. She doesn't know whether she'll ever get back again, this kind of thing. And it was just really amazing what she said. But she couldn't say that in English,
In English, she couldn't. So there was more. I've often thought of how I don't think I could stand going to a new country where I didn't speak the language, because because the way my ability to communicate is how I let people know who I am, I feel. And I would feel like no one would know me. I couldn't really ever be. I can't imagine, you know, being unable to have a mastery of the language.
Going to an area where you don't know the language that well, you don't get involved in the petty politics because you can't understand what they're saying.
That would be. So listen, we have to get, I can't wait till this film you're working on comes out. How amazing going to be.
Yeah. I've been going through a lot of footage I shot like on back in the 80s on VHS and beta and 3/4 inch, all that stuff you knew when you were working in the newsroom, I have it all digitized now, and I'm going through and cutting stuff like that I never edited before. The materials there, of course, it has a different meaning now as you look at stuff, you know, 30, 40 years later.
God knows. Well, it turns out, and I was shocked, although when I thought about it, I'm not. So you have been making films for 50 years.
Yeah, I'm shocked.
What the hell? I know. 50 years.
Yeah.
Years. God. And you've been making films that are so good that, you know, the honors have always come. But so there's going to be this, you will be honored at the Carnegie Museum of Art. Is it next week?
Next Saturday, on the 21st at 1:30, it's part of the Working Thought exhibit they have up, which is an amazing exhibit. I mean, it's a chance to get down to the Carnegie to see it. I think it's up sometime in June, until June. But this, so they did a film program with it, and so Lightning Over Braddock is included in the Working Thought exhibit, so we're showing it on Saturday at 1:30 at the at the theater at the Carnegie. And then what they're doing is, and I say, yeah, it's great. It'd be like 50 years and something doing. And then they decided to have this, there'll be a party in the courtyard after the.
To honor you. Yeah.
Yeah, to honor me. Yeah, I know. It's
hey,
wild.
Can anybody come? Do you have to have a...
It's free to the public, but I would go online and, I mean, the theater, I can't remember what that theater holds, maybe 160 or something like that. I would go online and reserve tickets, but it's free and open to the public, yes.
Okay, and so that's at 1:30 on a week from this Saturday.
Right.
Lightning over Braddock, a Rust Bowl fantasy.
Featuring Lynn Collin.
Oh, yeah. If you blink, you'll miss it. Is there any other way to see some of your films? I mean, are they any of them places people can access?
Right now, they have all been picked up. And there's both available on Blu-ray and DVD from a distributor named Kino Lorber out of New York City. And they're available, and, you know, if you go into Best Buy's website or Amazon website, Kino Lorber's website, actually Target, any Walmart, anywhere. And
really?
And search for that. Yeah. it's a 3D DVD. It's a 2D DVD set. It includes Lightning Over Braddock, plus extras, plus a narration track by me and another person, and then also a series of almost all my short films.
Wow.
Now,
without giving too much away, how would you describe Lightning Over Braddock, came out in 88? And
yeah. I fused a documentary and fiction, and what I wanted to do was play with the form, because there were so many great films made at that period of time, historical documentaries, but they all followed the same pattern of you'd interview somebody, you'd cut to some folk music or Pete Seeger with archival footage, then back to another person with the interview, and they had completed that form to. That there's nothing you could do to improve on that form that they had, the people that were doing those films. So I wanted to play with something that would actually get, instead of being just consumed, the people would look at the film and maybe even get upset with me as the director, because I have this sort of soap opera tale going on with Sal, with our personal struggle, and in the background, all the mills are closing. So I wanted the audience to look and say, why is he concentrating on this when the mills are closing in the background? And then, so just to pull you out and realize, you know, how everything is constructed that way. So I wanted to play with the form. Then also, I mean, what's kept the film alive is that none of the problems have been solved. So
no.
Some of the issues that are brought up then are still exist today. I mean,
well, exists today and even more so, it seems. These are people and places that have been left behind. Nobody cares.
Yeah,
and you always show the dignity of these people, the dignity, the humor, the you know, the fact that on a personal level they refuse to give up in hope or anything. I mean, that's
yeah. It was really. I mean, that's what struck me. Like when I started film school, and a lot of the films were being made, especially with ones on social issues. Everybody. It was like the people there had been defeated, and you're telling the story of more of their defeat, and this is what happened to them as victims. Where my experience is that, people really struggle all the time, but they're always fighting, and they always find humor to survive. And that was like sort of critical for me to put in it, because, I mean, that is a key to survival. It's someone who's just trying to find a humor in a situation so you just don't go crazy.
Well, that comes naturally to you. You're filled with compassion. You also are, I think, a historian by nature, but you're funny.
Yeah, that was because I was so short growing up. I had to be funny to avoid fights.
Yeah, it's a great defense mechanism that a lot of funny people find in their childhood. It's true.
Yeah. It was either like, okay, I was pretty clever, so you get in the games where you'd end up making fun of each other, and I was always able to compete in that. So the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which you're familiar with, is archiving all my work.
So
it'll be all great. So I've shipped them all the old outtakes and a lot of film stuff, and so in a place that's, you know, conditions of preservation, and I just have some papers, a couple other things to send them, then I'll go up and we'll try to figure out how to make stuff available online.
I think one of your one of the films that maybe more people here saw of yours was Struggles in Steel. Right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and that's to me, that's the one that really needs the preservation, because we, you know, it's an hour long, but we shot, you know, 60 hours worth of material or so. And,
wow.
And there's so many great interviews with these gentlemen that need, you know, that need to be seen again. I'm just hoping this way that people can use it for research as they talk about the safety in the mill, the pollutions in the mill, and of course the struggle for equal opportunity. I don't know, I'm really proud of it. And of course, it still plays a lot too. And people come up to me really. As a matter of fact, the other day just told me they thought it was one of the best historical films they've ever seen.
So that must be so gratifying for you that in fact you have cataloged, in 50 years, this history of this area that will. I mean, that lives forever, especially if, yes, you've got, you know, this archive that will be cared for and available.
Amazing. Yeah, it was one of these things like 50 years, you know, of course, when you're 28, and I actually got started late because I didn't start college until I was 24. So then, I went to film school and I started when I was 28. So 1972, I was like 29 years old, and, which is sort of late in starting a career back then. Today, at 29 years old, you're probably still working in a coffee shop trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life. But
And that's after being in debt a college degree, right?
I was so fortunate at that period of time I grew up when actually, you know, my grad school, I think, was $1,000 a year. I mean, that was it.
Wow. Yeah.
And yeah, then you ended up getting these loans that were like 2% and 3% to go to school.
Yeah.
And these kids today,
yeah.
it's just shameful. People say, you end up with all this debt. I mean, I went to undergrad, grad, and you know, maybe I ended up with $10,000 to $12,000 worth of debt, and some of it I just I don't know how much money I need. I just didn't want to work. You know, I wanted to work on my films and not and take a part-time job. So I accumulated some debt, but that was like nothing compared to what's going on today with the student.
No.
And then back then you could work in the summer and make almost enough money to pay for tuition for the year.
Yeah. We have really gone down, haven't we?
It's been a digression. I mean, for younger folks, it must be so hard. The idea of, you know, you would went to college back then, everybody chipped in $5, they lived in the house, so you're five, you have $25, you have enough food for the month, or the rent was for the place was like $50, $75. And it just is insane now for what pricing people out. And I know there's the talk about, you know, trade school, which is important, but it's also important for people from working backgrounds to go to universities. I mean, it's almost like you're trying to force this group of people out, going back to when in the 50s when you were assigned to wood shop, electric shop, whatever, if you weren't in the academic, and you were just, you know, you're just tracked into a career.
Well, it's a caste system, and we have, I think, we have the most incredible class system in this country. We're problem. I mean, upward mobility, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and if you are fortunate enough to have to move up in. Like I've been really fortunate. Okay, so I've moved. I have been able to move up. But I got to remember and always remember that it is really by design. They have to have a few people move up. And
oh, yes.
because the system would totally fail.
Alive. That's right.
Yeah,
right.
Keep that. And then what you're supposed to do, you're supposed to push the thing. Well, you know, because I worked hard, I was able to do it. You can work hard and do it.
That's
I mean,
right.
just BS.
That's right.
I mean, it's,
that's right.
Yeah. You have to realize that they let you do that. you're just fortunate and incidents happen, but you really have to remember where you came from all the time and not go into the whole thing of I made it, anybody can make it routine, which is, you know, up by the bootstraps. I mean, they just have to let it or collapse. It just goes back to Skinner's intermittent reinforcement. And I always use examples. If you just get behind a school bus and you see kids, you know, waving, you wave to them, then stop for a while, and they really start to go crazy and wave more, you know, to do it. And that's just sort of what they're relying on is that intermittent reinforces a few people breaking through and thinking everybody can do it.
Wow. See, you learned that in college. You didn't
yeah,
go
I learned
to college.
That. Yeah,
you
exactly. Right. What it's called. Yeah, exactly. I was actually a psych mate. I was a psych and philosophy major as an undergrad.
Well, you know what? That makes sense. I mean, in terms of you brought that, you bring that to your to your film work. You're a treasure, Tony. I thank you so much for taking the time out to talk. And I'm so sorry I'm not going to be able to be there Saturday. But you guys can. It's the 21st, 1:30. If they were to go to a website, just go to the Carnegie Museum of Art.
Yeah, just go to Carnegie Lightning Over Braddock or Carnegie Tony Buba. Right.
And have a chance to meet this wonderful guy. Really.
I'll have DVDs Tony. For sale, of course. Okay.
There'll be merch. That's right.
There'll be merch, right? And actually, I'm bringing a bunch of old cameras with me, 8mm and 16mm, and I have film for it, and I just want people to shoot stuff, and I'll put together as a little home movie of the event.
Oh, wow. Oh, my. You're something else. Tony Buba. I love you. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye. All right, guys, that's it for me. Check out his work if you have not. It's I mean, there have been rave reviews about it. I think I shared one with you a few years ago when the Museum of Modern Art in New York City had a retrospective of his. He is one of a kind. It's just a unique, independent filmmaker who's managed to do it for 50 years and has managed to document what happened, especially to his beloved hometown and to the steel industry here. It's a wonderful, wonderful artist and human. So thank you so much, and we got the week off, and I'll come back, you know, loaded for bear probably. So enjoy, and try to get out if you can into this beautiful weather. It's good for our souls. Love you all. Bye.
Lynn Cullen Live, Monday through Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and archived at pghcitypaper.com. The opinions expressed on Lynn Cullen Live are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints of Pittsburgh City Paper or its advertisers.